World News Today, brought to you by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as the leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's John Daly.
Heavy Allied air activity in Europe, in Africa, and in the Pacific is making secure the hard-won hold on the initiative that the United Nations have gained on all the fronts of this war. In French North Africa, the political situation has held the center of the stage. But every day, the military reports have told the story of Allied flyers pounding at the Axis supply ports and strafing and bombing Axis land communications. This is the all-important preliminary to any all-out land offensive. British planes bombed and machine-gunned enemy vehicles on the roads leading from the port of Sfax in Tunisia, and other Allied airmen continued to hammer at Axis targets around the clock. The raids were carried out by the new Bisley planes of the Royal Air Force. Meanwhile, French headquarters announced that French troops fighting northwest of Kairouan had seized several important points near Jebel de Babou. And now, for the news direct from French North Africa, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Algiers, Charles Collingwood reporting. Regret that due to transmission difficulties, we're not able to get the report from Charles Collingwood in Tunisia right now. So we turn to London for the report of a big air raid on Berlin. For the details, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS London, Bob Trout reporting.
London expects to get the details of last night's raid on Berlin sometime after midnight tonight, British time. So far, what we know about the Royal Air Force attack is that a strong force of heavy British bombers dropped a great weight of bombs on Berlin, and large fires were seen from the air. One bomber is missing from the strong force. Last night's was the 54th Royal Air Force raid on Berlin. The 53rd was made on a night in November of 1941. So, you see, Berlin went through the whole year of 1942 without a raid from the Royal Air Force, but the Russians were over Berlin a number of times. However, those early raids on Berlin were on a small scale, a very different operation from the kind that is now considered a normal raid, made on the principles of concentration and saturation of defenses, made with greater numbers of big four-engine bombers with their bombs of 4,000 pounds and 8,000 pounds. Those old raids were usually directed against single, important war targets, railroad stations, for instance, factories and power plants. If British bombers fly the most direct route to Berlin from this country, they have to cover some 1,200 miles, much of the journey over enemy territory. When the Royal Air Force planes arrive at the German capital, they have to face very powerful defenses. Still, from last night's raid, only one British plane is missing. London was glad to get today's Cairo communique, telling us of the opening of a new phase of the Battle of Tripolitania, but London was not surprised. Those strange German reports put out yesterday about fierce battles in which the Axis forces had stopped the Eighth Army bore a strong resemblance to those fake German reports which were put out back at El Agheila. This latest forward drive of the Eighth Army began at 7 o'clock Friday morning, and the latest reports in London are that the forward movement has been uninterrupted and the British have advanced some 40 or 50 miles from Wadi Zemzem. A British correspondent at the front with General Montgomery's forces says that the start of the 8th Army's new drive is the biggest moment since El Alamein. And now back to New York and John Daly.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
Several days ago, one of the CBS reporters heard on this program, Charles Collingwood, gave the world its first news of the French royalist plot to establish a monarchy in North Africa. Right now, you are listening to the dramatic story of history-making events. And in months to come, radio will give you every step in the complete defeat of the Axis. There's a story you won't want to miss. And the one way to make sure of hearing every single chapter is to take care of your radio. For you won't be able to get a new set until after the complete story is told. At present, your Admiral dealer can put almost any radio in perfect shape, regardless of make or condition. But as the weeks roll by, new parts will become increasingly difficult to obtain. So the wise man will call his Admiral dealer now and have minor adjustments made before vital parts are too far gone to be repaired. Remember, your radio set is a precious instrument, your only way of hearing the story of the battles as they are fought. And remember also, your Admiral dealer is the expert who will do everything possible to keep your radio in tip-top shape for the duration. Admiral dealers have the facilities, the knowledge, and the backing of Admiral. In peacetime, the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. Now here once again, for Admiral Radio, is John Daly.
Now for news of the situation along the Pacific war fronts, Admiral Radio takes you after a few seconds' pause to CBS Australia, William J. Dunn reporting.
Australia's eternal bugaboo, shortage of manpower, promises to become even more serious during the few months just ahead. Prime Minister Curtin's statement that at least 210,000 persons will be needed for war work or for active service within the next 6 months poses a situation which he himself described as of utmost gravity. 210,000 persons doesn't sound so large when considered in the light of America's population. But in a nation of 7 million, where more than one out of every 10 persons is wearing the uniform of the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, or one of the women's auxiliaries, it's a staggering order. Actually, 210,000 Australians is the proportion equal of nearly 4 million Americans. And when America reaches its fourth year of war, 4 million able-bodied men and women not already working for the war effort will be hard to find. The Prime Minister is frank in his admission that the answer to this problem has not yet been found. But unless the answer is found, the probable alternatives are curtailment of war production or starving the services of reinforcements, he said. General Sir Thomas Blamey, commander of the Allied land forces in the Southwest Pacific area, in a radio talk to Australia a few hours ago, warned against any feeling that our signal success in Papua meant that the Japanese menace to Australia has ended. He praised the joint work of the American and Australian soldier in the Buna campaign, but predicted that Japan is still anxious to eliminate Australia as a possible Allied base from which a successful offensive might be launched. He pointed out that in New Guinea, the peril of tropical diseases was even more deadly than the menace of the Japanese. This is William J. Dunn in Australia. I return you to CBS in New York.
In the Far East, British bombers supporting the British drive in western Burma against Akyab successfully bombed targets on Akyab Island, and heavy bombers of the United States 10th Air Force left a 7,000-ton Jap cargo vessel sinking and another ship damaged in a Jap convoy south of Rangoon. Thus, new news of aerial activity in the Far East. Besides these major raids, today, Allied flyers, mostly fighters, dropped light bombs and machine gun Jap trains and coastal shipping. The ground forces are still fighting about 25 miles from Akyab. Once again, the reports, as in Europe, from the Far East are reports of air activity, of Allied efforts to smash at the enemy's communications, not only to smash at his principal bases of communication and supply, but also to cut into his equipment for the transport of those supplies. The news from Cairo this morning that the British 8th Army is again on the offensive is news that is good news because we've waited for it for several days. The latest dispatches say that the Allied forces have swept to within 110 miles of the Axis base of Tripoli. You'll remember that the British 8th Army struck Friday at two points, at the center of the Axis line and also at the Axis right flank. It skirted the impassable depression there and drove into the open desert where Rommel has little chance of digging in for another stand. Thus, the news of Montgomery's 8th Army once again in action. And it's news that ties in with the news of the French force that came up from the Lake Chad area in Africa and which, for the past several weeks, has been winning one battle after another. This French force is, of course, still several hundred miles south of Tripoli, still several hundred miles south of the flank of Rommel's army. But it's a factor that has to be considered in the fighting that is going on now in Tripolitania. How far the French force will be able to move without further supplies and perhaps without having to wait some time to pull up major supplies from its bases, no one as yet can tell. but it's very possible that the British Eighth Army may find itself operating with a friend on its flank much sooner than it's expected. We expect to have the news from Cairo direct. Bob Trout has already given us a report on the fighting in Libya from London. And for further details, Admiral Radio takes you now direct to the Columbia correspondent in Cairo.
The Eighth Army, having pushed the Germans through the German defenses west of Duarat, continued the attack today and kept up the pressure on Rommel's fighting rear guard. General Montgomery's advanced units were heading up the tarmac road that leads north to Misurata. They were striking across hard desert to the west and northwest. They were pursuing the enemy in three directions, while supply columns with fuel and ammunition were piling after them. Latest reports placed British forward troops on a line that runs roughly east to west across 50 miles of Tripolitanian plateau. The westernmost point on that line is due south of Homs. The battle that picked the Africa Corps off the Buerat area on Friday night was the first head-on clash the British have had with the enemy since Alamein. But it was not a large-scale battle. Rommel did not pit his whole strength against it. He did not have all his available forces lined up along the Zemzem Gully. He had already withdrawn a fair number of his troops so that he could make a fast getaway when he saw the British steamroller coming. At the same time, he massed enough guns and armor around Zemzem to make the British attack. It was familiar Rommel tactics, delaying as long as he could with a minimum of losses when it came to a showdown. British troops are now rampant in open desert, and I imagine Rommel will have a harder time now than he did at the Gala in keeping the place littered with minefields. But there's no reason to think the Eighth Army will have a clean, easy sweep all the way to Tripoli. The eastern approaches to that city are covered by a chain of hills slanting inland from the coast near Homs. So Rommel may practice his favorite delaying technique again. He has an estimated 50,000 troops, including some crack German infantry battalions. Somewhere in the background, he has three Italian divisions. I don't think any of these are going to stop the Eighth Army for long, but there will probably be a few more hurdles to scale before the British get to Tripoli. This is Winston Burdett in Cairo. I return you now to CBS in New York.
Again, we turn to the Pacific for some intimate glimpses of the war in that theater. Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Honolulu, Webley Edwards reporting.
Share the credit for the capture and retention of our base in Guadalcanal must go to the American fighter plane squadron. Just returned to Pearl Harbor are two young naval officers who actually controlled many of the spectacular combats in the skies above the Solomons. These are Commander John H. Griffin of Annapolis, Maryland, who directed fighter operations from a carrier, and Ensign William Knoll of Pasadena, California, who directed Marine, Navy, and Army fighter groups out of Guadalcanal. Commander Griffin, is your carrier still doing her stuff against the Japs?
She sure is. Her boys are knocking the Zeros and Colonies for a loop every time they can find them.
They tell us you fellows have been shooting them down at a rate of 4 or 5 to 1 down there. How do you account for this?
The main reasons are better pilots with lots of armor in the seats of their pants. The good old Grumman Wildcat is a sturdy airplane, and plenty of 50 caliber machine guns don't do any harm either. In fleet operations such as those we have just been through, the accuracy and volume of our ship's anti-aircraft fire is another powerful factor on our side.
In what recent battle did you observe these factors most effectively combined?
In the off the Santa Cruz Islands, when our squadrons and anti-aircraft knocked down more than 100 Jap planes.
Do you expect important carrier battles in the future?
Certainly. We've got to wipe out the Japs' carriers before we hit him where he lives.
Commander, do you recall any particular incident that typifies the makeup of our flyers?
Yes. One day when our force was being shadowed by a 4-engine Kawanishi, I directed the standby patrol to attack. In a few minutes, both the Jap and our patrol disappeared from view. I was getting pretty anxious about the result of the chase, but I hated to bother our fighters by asking unnecessary questions when I knew they were plenty busy. When I could restrain myself no longer, I asked the leader, "What's the dope? Any luck?" He came right back with a model four-word report. Kawanishi found and down.
Commander, did your force have a hand in turning the Japs back in the big battles around Savo Island in November?
Our battleships, cruisers, and destroyers did, of course, and our air group dished out plenty of damage on their own. Our dive bombers and torpedo planes got in their licks on the transports, and the fighters sure knocked down their share of the Zeros. Bill Noel can tell you more about the operation down at Guadalcanal.
How about that, Bill?
Every pilot did a great job, and I think that General Woods of the Marine Corps deserves a lot of credit. It was a wonderful example of a unified command. Not only the Marines, but the Navy and the Army and the New Zealand squadrons, too, were there. And the General had them working together, not as separate units, but as one force. The attack troops often consisted of Navy torpedo planes and Army bombers, escorted by combined Navy and Marine fighters. But both the Army and Navy pilots had to take off their huffs, the Marine dive bomber pilots. They were the workhorses the entire campaign.
The dummy operating conditions on Henderson Field are pretty tough.
Conditions are still difficult, but they're a lot worse in October. The pilots didn't live as aviators are properly supposed to. They slept in muddy foxholes at night when they could sleep, and ate when they could find the time. The pilots were billeted only a half mile from the Japanese positions. They fought Jap raids, mud, and dust every day. There was no picnics for the mechanics either. The pilots' success in shooting down so many Japs was in a large part due to the mechanics' upkeep of their planes.
In a word, what's the air situation down there today, Commander Griffin?
The situation's a lot better than it was last August, but we still have a tough job ahead of us. Our boys, who are meeting the Japs over the Solomons every day, must have a continuous flow of planes, ships, and supplies. These must constantly increase.
Thank you, Commander John Griffin and Ensign William Noel, for your excellent close-up of our air operations against the Jap and the Solomons. Good luck. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor. We return you to CBS in New York.
Biggest United Nations successes are still in Russia. For that story, here is Larry Lesser, Columbia's correspondent who recently returned from Moscow.
The ice of the frozen river Don is blotched with red today, and Adolf Hitler's prestige among the German people, and above all within the German army, is being struck the first of many blows from which it will never recover. Those red banner armies of Russia are surging back over the white blanketed wheat fields of the Soviet Southwest, and the rich black earth which Hitler's conquered last summer, at such a cost of blood and machines, is slipping from the frozen fingers of his armies at a rate which astounds everyone, except the Russians. In that red-walled citadel set up in the center of snowy Moscow, called the Kremlin, the Russian high command is planning its moves as carefully as on a chessboard. And today, with a smashing move against the remnants of Hitler's crack Fifth Army trapped outside Stalingrad, they are calling checkmate on Hitler's last summer offensive against the Volga and his chief city, Stalingrad. From every side, the heavy booty, fur-hatted peasant army of Russia is pouring fire into these 75,000 Germans and Romanians who have not denied any way of escape. Here, the trapped Germans are holding 60,000 starving Russian peasants and workers as hostages. Many persons have forgotten the great migration of Russian factories and workers from the conquered lands last year, but the workers haven't forgotten. Settled now in New Eastudoka, in the Urals, and Siberia, their factories are now turning out equipment which is making the present Russian offensive possible. And with every step that they advance, the Red Army is winning back for its wives and mothers in the factories the richest agricultural lands in all Europe. Every foot of this blood-soaked black earth will grow food for Russia next spring. The Russians make a practice of never announcing an offensive until it's achieved some success, but there are rumors that they are moving to free Leningrad at the long end of the battle line. Just a year ago today, I talked to the Russian general who will play a great role in this gigantic task. Dark, incisive-looking General Gavorov, smasher of the Finnish Mannerheim land, the artillery expert who cracked the German stronghold at Mozhaisk. I talked to him in the smoking ruins of Mozhaisk, 60 miles in front of Moscow. He said, "We are counting on our allies, and until they are ready, we will give the invaders no rest until they are finally driven across the frontiers of Russia."
There are many news developments at home today also. For that news, Admiral Radio takes you next to CBS Washington, Lee White reporting.
If you look at your calendar, you'll find, as I did, that March 15th is only 8 weeks hence. And unless Congress gets busy and passes some plan for paying as you go between now and then, March 15th is liable to cause a breakdown in our tax-collecting machinery. The Treasury says everyone's got to make his return and arrange for lump or quarterly payment of his taxes between now and March 15th, or take the customary consequences in the form of a cash penalty. But many people, especially here in Washington, are certain that some form of pay-as-you-go will last, and they're not planning to make any income tax returns until it is. This means that the Treasury is going to have an even greater number of delinquencies this year than heretofore expected. In order to avoid a muddle over taxes, therefore, many congressmen have suddenly decided that pay-as-you-go has got to be given priority over all other pending legislation. members of the House Ways and Means Committee are now considering a plan to separate pay-as-you-go from other taxation measures and rush it through Congress as quickly as possible. Other legislation due to receive priority has to do with the 48-hour week. Senator Reed of Kansas, with strong Republican backing, has just presented a resolution to repeal the wage and hour law and return to the 48-hour working week. Walter Reuter of the United Auto Workers is also advocating a 48-hour week, and so is Secretary of Labor Perkins, but with a difference. Mr. Reuter would retain the wage and hour law and guarantee 48 hours of employment every week to every worker. There's no fresh news about the Pennsylvania strike, which could be over tomorrow. There was a communique at 1 o'clock. It reports continued American bombings of the enemy airdrome at Munda in the Solomons and another Japanese bombing of our own positions on Guadalcanal. Some casualties were suffered among our troops, the Navy says, but material damage was slight, and our troops continued to advance despite the stiffening enemy resistance. I now return you to CBS New York and John Daly.
And now Admiral Radio brings you Columbia's military expert, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The British Eighth Army has struck boldly and apparently with great power in the direction of the Axis base at Tripoli. Abandoning the coastal road and its difficult salt marshes, General Montgomery has made a wide sweep through the open desert and is reported only 110 miles from Tripoli. Such a move indicates that Montgomery is satisfied that he is well superior in mobile fighting power, especially armored power, to any opposition that the depleted forces of Marshal Rommel can offer. Montgomery is a hard-headed, tough soldier who does not take reckless chances. His drive for Tripoli bypasses the German position at Misurata, which will be hopelessly isolated if Montgomery reaches the coast at Tripoli or anywhere between Tripoli and Misurata. This means that Misurata will probably fall into British hands and will then form an excellent advance base for the British, as is the first good harbor, west, that is, the first point at which the British Navy could resume its work of supplying Montgomery's army on a large scale. Hence, Montgomery must have collected the supplies and equipment needed for his present push by using the long, weary desert road from Cyrenaica, and this accounts for the long pause in these operations. Meanwhile, the Allied air forces at the port of Tripoli, which has made it difficult for Rommel to build up his own strength through that harbor.
And now, Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio. These next few seconds might be used in describing the new Admiral radios to be made after peace has come. But right now, all Admiral facilities are devoted to producing radio equipment for America's war effort, most of it under direct supervision of the Army Signal Corps. And Admiral would like to pass along a little of the respect it feels for this great branch of our fighting forces. The United States Army has the finest communications equipment in the world, not by accident, but because the Army Signal Corps has worked night and day through peace and war to devise, invent, and improve communications equipment. The search for better signal equipment started with the first chief signal officer America had, Albert Meyer, who devised wigwag communication, and the search still goes on. Every piece of equipment accepted must be better than the piece which went before. Small wonder, then, that Admiral considers it a privilege to work with the Army Signal Corps. For Admiral has always had that same aim, to make better and better radio equipment, an aim which will continue after the smoke of battle is cleared, when Admiral will again produce fine radios for American homes. Admiral radios, America's smart set. A 2-cent bullet can stop a Nazi in his tracks. So how about buying a few bullets for our boys to shoot? Five for a 10-cent war stamp, and those war stamps will fill that stamp book you started and forgot. Fill it. Change it for an interest-bearing war bond. Come on, America. There's 100 million partially filled stamp books lying around. Let's fill them completely this week. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave direct from the leading news centers of the world. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Our next news broadcast will be at 4:45 this afternoon. This is the WBBM Air Theater, your station in the Wrigley Building, Chicago.